I lived long, answered Joseph, at the sight of a man who did not know how to be surprised, for he was steadiness itself. He was my taskmaster in the prison. He taught me that steadiness is nothing but being prepared for everything. So I am not overwhelmingly surprised. I am in Pharaoh's hand. And in your hands shall be the lands, and you shall be as myself before all the people, said Amenhotep with feeling. Take this in the first place, said he. With nervous fingers he jerked and pulled a ring over his knuckle and thrust it upon Joseph's hand. It was an oval lapis lazuli of exceptional beauty in a high setting. It glowed like the sunlit heavens, and the name Aton within the royal cartouche was engraved on the stone. That shall be the sign, Mani went on with passion, once more growing quite pale, of your plenary power and representative status, and whoever sees it shall tremble and know that each word you utter to one of my servants, be he the highest or the lowest, shall be as my own word. Whoever has a request to Pharaoh, he shall come first before you, and your word shall be kept and obeyed, because wisdom and reason stand at your side. I am Pharaoh. I set you over all the land of Egypt, and without your will shall no one stir hand or foot in the two lands. Only by the height of the royal seat shall I be higher than you, and lend you of the loftiness and splendor of my throne. You shall drive in my second chariot, just behind mine, and they shall run alongside and shout, Take care, take your heart to you, here is the father of the lands. You shall stand before my throne, and have the power of the keys, unlimited. I see you shake your head, little mamma. You turn it away, and I hear you murmur something about extravagance. But there can be something splendid about extravagance, and just now Pharaoh is bent on extravagance. You shall have a title and style confirmed to you, Lamb of God, such as was never before heard of in Egypt, and in it your death name shall disappear. We have, of course, the two viziers, but I will create for you the as yet unknown title of Grand Vizier. But that will not be nearly enough. You shall be called, in addition, Friend of the Harvest of God, and Sustainer of Egypt, and Shadow Spender of the King, Father of Pharaoh, and whatever else happens to occur to me, though just now I am so happy and excited that nothing else does. Do not shake your head, Mama. Let me this one time have my fun, for I am extravagant on purpose and consciously. It is grand that it will happen as in the foreign song that goes, Father Enlil has named his name Lord of the Lands. He shall administer all realms over which I hold sway. All my obligations shall he take to himself. His land shall flourish. He himself shall be in health. His word shall stand firm. What he commands shall not be changed. Not any god shall alter the word of his mouth. As it goes in the song, and as the foreign hymn says, so shall it be. And it gives me infinite pleasure. Prince of the interior and vice god, so shall you be called at the investiture. We cannot undertake your gilding here. There is no adequate treasure house out of which I can reward you with gold, with collars and chains. We must go back at once to Waset. It can only be there, at Merimat, in the palace, in the great court under the balcony. And a wife must be found for you from the best circles. That is, of course, a whole lot of wives, but first of all, the first and true one, for it is settled that I am going to see you married. You will find out what a pleasure that is. And Amenhotep clapped his hands with the eager unrestraint of a child. Hey, he called breathlessly to the chamberlain, who came crouching forward. We are leaving. Pharaoh and the whole court are going back to Noet Amon today. Make haste. It is a gracious command. Make ready my boat, Star of the Two Lands. I will travel on it with the Eternal Mother, the sweet consort, and this elect one, the Adon of my house, who from now on shall be as myself in Egypt. Tell it to the rest. There will be a tremendous gilding. The hunchback had, of course, been close to the portieres the whole time. He had listened with all his might, but he had not trusted his ears. Now he was forced to believe, and we can imagine how he fawned like a kitten and bridled and kissed his fingertips. Chapter 4. The Time of Enfranchisement. 7 or 5. It is well that this conversation between Pharaoh and Joseph, which led to the lifting up of the departed one, so that he was made great in the West, this famous and yet almost unknown conversation, which the great mother who was present not unaptly called a conversation of gods about God, has now been re-established from beginning to end in all its turnings, windings, and conversational episodes. Well that it has been set down with exactitude once and for all, so that everyone can follow the course which in its time it pursued in reality, so that if some point or other should slip the memory, one need only turn back and read. The summary nature of the tradition up till now almost makes it, however venerable, unconvincing. For instance, upon Joseph's interpretation and his advice to the king to look about for a wise and knowledgeable and forethoughted man, Pharaoh straightway answers, "Nobody is so knowledgeable and wise as you. I will set you over all Egypt," and overwhelms him on the spot with the most extravagant honors and dignities. There is too much abridgment and condensation about this. It is too dry. It is a drawn and salted and embalmed remnant of the truth, not truth's living lineaments. Pharaoh's inordinate enthusiasm and favor seem to lack foundation and motivation. Long ago, when, overcoming the shrinking of our flesh, we pulled ourselves together for the trip down through millennial abysses, down to the regions below, to the field and the fountain where Joseph was standing, even so long ago, what we were actually after was to listen to that very conversation, and to bring it back with us in all its members as it really came to pass and took place at On in Lower Egypt. Of course, there is really nothing against condensation in itself. It is useful and even necessary. In the long run, it is quite impossible to narrate life just as it flows. What would it lead to? Into the infinite. It would be beyond human powers. Whoever got such an idea fixed in his head would not only never finish, he would be suffocated at the outset, entangled in a web of delusory exactitude, a madness of detail. No, excision must play its part at the beautiful feast of narration and recreation. It has an important and indispensable role. Here, then, the art will be judiciously practiced to the end of getting finally quit of a preoccupation which, though after all it has a distant kinship with the attempt to drink the sea dry, must not be driven to the extreme and utter folly of actually and literally doing so. What would have become of us, for instance, when Jacob was serving with the devil Laban 7 and 13 and 5? In short, 25 years, of which every tiniest time element was full of a life in itself, quite worth telling. And what would have become of us now, without that reasonable principle, when our little bark, driven by the measuredly moving stream of narration, hovers again on the brink of a time cataract of 7 and 7 prophesied years? Well, to begin with, and just among ourselves, in these 14 years, things were neither quite so definitely good nor so definitely bad as the prophecy would have them. It was fulfilled, no doubt about that, but fulfilled as life fulfills, imprecisely, for life and reality always assert a certain independence, sometimes on such a scale as to blur the prophecy out of all recognition. Of course, life is bound to the prophecy, but within those limits it moves so freely that one almost has one's choice as to whether the prophecy has been fulfilled or not. In our present case, we are dealing with a time and a people animated by the best will in the world to believe in the fulfillment, however inexact. For the sake of the prophecy, they are willing to agree that 2 and 2 make 5, if the phrase may be used in a context where not 5 but an even higher odd number, namely 7, is in question. Probably this would constitute no great difficulty, 5 being almost as respectable a number as 7. And surely no reasonable man would insist that 5 instead of 7 could constitute an inexactitude. In fact and in reality, the prophesied 7 looked rather more like 5. Life, being living, put no clear or absolute emphasis on either number.
The fat and the lean years did not come up out of the womb of time to balance each other so unequivocally as in the dream. The fat and lean years that came were like life, in not being entirely fat or entirely lean. Among the fat ones were one or two which might have been described as certainly not lean, but to a critical eye, as certainly no more than very moderately fat. The lean ones were all lean enough, at least 5 of them, if not 7, but among them there may have been a couple which did not reach the last extreme of exiguity, and even halfway approached the middling. Indeed, if the prophecy had not existed, they might not have been recognized as years of famine at all. As it was, they were blithely reckoned in along with the others. Does all this detract from the fulfillment of the prophecy? Of course not. Its fulfillment is incontestable, for we have the fact, the facts of our tale, of which our tale consists, without which it would not be in the world, and without which, after the snatching away and the lifting up, the making to come after could not have happened. Certainly things were fat and lean enough in the land of Egypt and adjacent regions, years long fat and years long more or less lean, and Joseph had plenty of chance to husband the plenty and distribute the crying lack, and, like Utnapishtim Atrakasis, like Noah the exceeding wise one, to prove himself a man of prudence and foresight, whose ark rocks safe on the flood. In loyal service to the highest, he did this as his minister, and by his dealings he gilded Pharaoh over and over again. The gilding. But for the present, it was himself who was gilded. For to become a man of gold was the phrase the children of Egypt used for what now happened to him, when, by Pharaoh's gracious command, together with this god, the queen mother, the sweet consort, and the princesses Nezimut and Bakhet-Aton, he had made the journey upstream on the royal bark, Star of the Two Lands, back to Weset, amid the plaudits of the crowded shores. There, with the Sun family, he made his entry into the Palace of the West, Merimat, set in its gardens, and with the lake of its gardens, at the foot of the high-colored desert hills. There he received spacious quarters, servants, raiment, and everything for his comfort and pleasure, and as early as the second day, the state function of the investiture and gilding was held, beginning with the ceremonial progress by the court, when the purchased slave did actually drive in Pharaoh's second car, directly behind the monarch, and surrounded by his Syrian and Nubian bodyguard and fan-bearers, separated from the car of the god only by a troop of runners who cried, Abrech, and Take care, and Grand Vizier, and Behold the Father of the Land. By this means it was made known to the populace what was going on, and who that was in the second car. At least they saw and understood that Pharaoh had made someone very great, for which he must have had his own reasons, even if only it was his gracious will and whim, that being quite reason enough. Moreover, since the idea of a dawning of a new age and great improvement in all things was somehow always bound up with such an investiture and lifting up, Weset's people exulted greatly on the housetops and hopped on one leg along the avenues. They shouted, Pharaoh, Pharaoh, and Nebnephnezem, and Great is Aton. And you might even distinguish this name pronounced with a softer sound, Adon, Adon, doubtless referring to Joseph. For it had probably leaked out that he was an Asiatic, and it seemed proper, particularly to the women, to hail him by the name of the Syrian Lord and Bridegroom, not least because he whom they thus distinguished was so very young and handsome. It should be added here that among all his titles it was this name which stuck, and in all the land of Egypt he was called Adon all his life, in speaking both to and of him. After this fine procession, they were all ferried across the river to the west bank and back to the palace, where there was now to take place the ceremony of the gilding, always wonderful and this time simply irresistible to the eye and the heart. Its course was as follows. Pharaoh, and she who filled the palace with love, Nefer-Nefru-Apton, the queen, showed themselves at the so-called audience window, actually not a window but a sort of balcony giving on an inner court of the palace, a pillared terrace in front of the great reception hall. It was magnificently constructed of malachite and azure, and adorned with bronze uraei. But in front of this was still another little structure, supported on enchantingly garlanded lotus columns. Its broad balustrade was covered with gay cushions, and on these their majesties leaned to fling down the gold presents of every shape and sort, handed them by officers of the treasure house upon the lucky man standing below on the terrace. The present recipient, of course, was no other than Joseph, the son of Jacob. The scene, and all that went with it, were never forgotten by those who once saw it. Everything swam in a sea of color and pomp, of extravagant favor and fervid ecstasy. The splendid fretwork of the architecture, the banners flapping in the breeze under a sunny sky from the gay, gilded, and painted wooden columns, the blue and red whisks and fans of the ranking retainers who filled the court, dressed in flowing gala aprons, bowing and scraping, cheering and paying homage, women striking tambourines, boys with the youth lock told off to jump for joy without stopping, the hosts of scribes in their customary obsequious posture, writing down with their reeds everything that happened, the view through three wide-open gates into the outer court, full of vehicles whose prancing horses carried tall colored plumes on their heads, and behind them the drivers facing the scene with them, bowing low and lifting their arms. Looking in on all this from outside, the red and yellow mountains of Thebes, dark blue and violet in their shadowy depths, and on the splendid ceremonial estrade, the godlike pair, fragile and smiling in their languid elegance, wearing their high cap-like crowns with the drapery protecting the back of their necks, uninterruptedly, with obvious enjoyment, tossing out of an inexhaustible store the shower and dower of valuables on the favored one below. Strings of gold beads, gold in the shape of lions, gold armbands, gold daggers, gold fillets, collars, scepters, vases, hatchets, all out of fine gold. The recipient, of course, could not catch them all, so he had two slaves to heap up in front of him on the ground, a veritable golden hoard, glittering in the sunshine amid the onlookers' admiring cries. Yes, this was certainly, take it all in all, the prettiest scene imaginable. And were it not for the inexorable laws of abridgment and condensation, it would be described here in much greater detail.